everyone is feeling here, you know, we're also a circle of trauma. Israeli Americans in the U.S., American Jews, it's also impacted us. I'm sure you've heard the October 8th Jew term so many times.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
Before we begin, I'd like to remind our viewers and our listeners that we really appreciate your support, and you can go and support us on patreon.com/ShaiDavidai. All of this is because of you, and none of this could be done without you. So thank you very much for those who are already supporting us, and look forward to the many more who will be supporting us in the future. My guest today is the CEO of American Friends of Natal, an Israeli NGO that specializes in trauma treatment, PTSD, and community resilience building among civilian populations. One of their values or in their mission statement is not all wounds are visible, which I expect to be discussing a lot about today. But without further ado, here I am with Maayan Aviv.
Thank you, Shai. It's an honor to meet you.
It's really, thank you so much for coming. And Maayan, before we get to talking about what Natal does, how Natal fits in all of everything that's happening in Israel, I want to get to know you better just a little bit. So Maayan Aviv, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm an Israel-loving, active Jew, meaning I do think Judaism requires work, and I'm not talking about secular or non-secular, but I think in today's world, you have to be very true to your identity as a Jew to live your life.
So how are you true? What does your active Jewishness come out as?
I think first and foremost, as a parent, it's teaching your children my history, my husband's history, where our families come from, and keeping tradition in the household. And I think externally, I've done it with my line of work, with choosing to work in organizations that support Israel in one way or another.
So let's get to that. And you are currently the CEO of American Friends of Natal. But you've had a long way to that. So tell me your path. How did you become involved in Jewish philanthropy?
So after my army service in Israel, and as a child, I went back and forth from living in Israel and living in the U.S. You could say I had plenty of both worlds in the best possible way.
Because you were born in
the U.S. I was born in the U.S. I grew up in Israel as a young child, moved to the U.S. During elementary, middle school, and then completed high school and my army service in Israel. So at that point in my life, it had been 50-50 exactly. And I decided to come to the U.S. and meet up with some old friends. And life kept going, and I went to school here. And when I finished school, I said, well, where should I look for work? And at the time, Jewish Jobs was the best platform to find something in the Jewish world. And I knew that I wanted to take my skill set and my knowledge as both Israeli and American and translate that into my line of work. And so that's how I found my first job at American Friends of Alin Hospital. I joined as the database administrator and really got to learn every single job within the organization. And about 8 years after I had been in the organization, I was promoted to the CEO position.
How old were you?
I was 36, very 36. Young for a CEO.
So you started at 28, just because you wanted to do something in the Jewish philanthropy world, and you basically did every role possible in the organization, made your way up to CEO. I think that's very inspiring for a lot of people listening, watching, and feeling, you know, their contribution is limited.
I think your contribution can be as big as you want it to be. And it's all a learning curve and listening to the needs and learning things that don't necessarily, that aren't necessarily defined in your scope of work. So I remember a month into my position at Alin, I said, well, I haven't seen a full cycle A to Z of the donor life. So a check comes in, what happens? What do you do with that donor? What happens with the systems? So there's this circle that you need to learn, and everybody plays a role in the donor cycle. But I think the advantage is if you are able to learn every single step of the way and then implement it into your own professional development.
What was the next step for you?
Strategic.
After leaving Alin?
I knew I was a young CEO, and I knew that about 5 years was the mark. I left a little over 2 years, 4 years, sorry, into my role as a CEO. And at the time, I went through a process, a professional process of guidance to see what kind of career path I wanted to take. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I grow up. And so,
and this was when, how old were you when you didn't know?
I was in my, I was turning 40 at the time. So it wasn't that long ago. And I hope I encourage anyone who doesn't know what they want to do that it's okay. And I took all these tests with a career coach, and every single test came back one way or another: work with meaning and lead, CEO, manage. Those are my, that's my skill set. And so I knew I had to continue combining that. And when the opportunity from Natal came, I said, okay, this is a great opportunity, but I did not know what I was getting myself into pre-October 7th as a CEO for American Friends of Natal.
So before we delve into what Natal does, why did you see it as a great opportunity for yourself? What attracted you to Natal?
The people, first and foremost. I met their CEO, Efrat Chaput, in New York, and I saw an impressive woman, a woman that I wanted to learn from, a woman who is able to manage in emergency and routine and see a bigger picture. And I met their founder, Jude Yovel-Recanati, a philanthropist, a woman with a vision, an inspiration. And at the time, I felt that I wanted to be surrounded by strong, powerful women who could teach me, who could mentor me. I also, the organization itself, what it does, really the mission spoke to me. And I thought I understood it. I was humbled to learn more as I went into this line of work. But I also saw it as an opportunity to take an organization that has been existing for 20 years in the U.S. and educate people about it, because nobody knew what Natal did before October 7th.
So what does Natal do?
So as you said, Natal is Israel's Trauma and Resilience Center. It has been in existence for 28 years. It was founded by Jude Yovel-Recanati. At the time, so almost 30 years ago, she saw the need from the Yom Kippur veterans who were coping with PTSD. And so that's how the idea was born. And fast forward to today, Natal has three helplines, a clinical unit, a community resiliency unit, a school of studies, and a research and development unit, and our career development unit. So it has really grown into a one-stop shop of both providing trauma services for people coping with trauma and PTSD, but also building resilience within Israeli communities during routine time, as much as that's possible.
And we will really hopefully get to each and every one of these projects, but I do want to take a step back and say, why is there a need for Natal in the first place? everything you've just described sounds like something that a government should be doing.
And that's true. But we know the Israeli government has a lot of bureaucracy. And we also know that Israeli society has a lot of shame about admitting, I have nightmares. I am unable to function in my work life. And so Natal was an NGO created to provide that space, that support in between when some cases are so critical that they have to go for government recognition. And also Natal aids with a lot of the stigma that is around PTSD and coping with trauma. So it's an NGO that offers the service, I guess, in between the government and nothing. And it works for many, many, many individuals.
So let's talk about who is your, who receives your services pre-October 7. I assume that in the 28 years of existence, 26 years before the October 7 massacre, it has changed. Who was Natal servicing in the beginning stages? What happened? Who's the bulk of the people receiving the trauma services?
So pre-October 7th, it was mainly Yom Kippur veterans. It was people who have unfortunately been a part of any terror attack, missile shooting. So we were servicing a lot of people from Otef Aza, from the south of Israel, pre-October 7th, because that was their day-to-day, also up north.
And what was their day-to-day?
Their day-to-day rockets. That threat has always been there, even pre-October 7th. So we had a lot of resiliency areas, homes, houses for children, especially. This is, I'm talking pre-October 7th, to create some sort of activity and engagement. We know that human connection is the foundation for building resiliency. And so that's what Natal was doing before. Our helpline always peaked when there was an incident, big or small, but the helpline has always been there. And we have two helplines. So one is dedicated for Israeli civilians. Anyone in Israel can call. We offer services in Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian. And then the other helpline was for IDF veterans. So once you're out of the army, you're a veteran, you're no longer under the umbrella of the IDF, but you still need services. So they were able to call this helpline that was operated in partnership with the Ministry of Defense. So back to your government question, there is a lot of cooperation and partnership, just not in all areas. So especially with IDF veterans, their helpline was specifically funded by the Ministry of Defense.
So I'm really interested in the Gaza envelope, the angle of helping children, because that to me is how I first discovered Natal. I learned about Natal as this organization that's giving these children who grew up in the kibbutzim, in Sderot, under constant threat. Now, these children are no longer children. They are probably in the 30s, since 2006, basically. How can you help? What can you do for a child who that's their reality? It's not a trauma that's going to go away anytime soon. The traumatic experience keeps happening. What does Natal do there?
I think, and I say this from a learning place, not from a mental health professional perspective, but from what I've seen, it's teaching children, people, how to cope with an abnormal situation and understand that while their response does not seem normal, it's creating a narrative that explains the situation to them so that they can cope. They know what superpowers they have within them to deal with the situation. So whether it's, and I just heard this Zoom on Saturday night, you know, you're going into the safe room, what are you going to take there with you that's going to comfort you? Because you know you're going into an uncomfortable situation. So it's not changing reality, but rather giving people actual tools and ideas that come from them. That's what makes it authentic and impactful, that come from them. So they're coming in prepared because the preparedness came from within. And I would say that's resiliency, right? It's the ability to move forward. So we know the days ahead are not going to be easy. What are we doing individually and collectively as a society to make sure that we get through these next few days as strong as we can?
Who are the people on your side? Who are these volunteers? Are these employees? I pick up a phone call to call the hotline. Who's on the other side?
So our helpline is manned by volunteers, which is incredible. They go through a 6-month training period.
How many people are we talking
about? So Natal has about today close to 200 volunteers. Before the war, it was 100. We've also had to have our social workers join the helpline because some of the calls by nature are difficult and always supervision by, you know, therapist or psychologist to really handle the tough calls and also be there to offer guidance to the volunteers. And I think that's the reality we have to remember, that the person answering the call on the other side is also dealing with their own reality that is shared with the other person on the line, but also is personal.
So I pick up the phone. What are the most common things that people bring up in these phone calls?
Usually they're calls about anxiety. So the volunteer will do some breathing techniques or get a casual conversation going or reminder of, you know, what is with your control and what is not. A lot of calls from mothers who need to tell their children what's happening. And a lot of calls with people who don't know what to do because they don't have a safe room in their house. So what's the next best thing or what should we do? I've heard extremely difficult situations that both volunteers and individuals are coping with throughout this all. And it's just, it's a reminder again that that human connection makes a difference.
It's interesting because the two things that the human connection brings in, according to what you're saying, is one, the emotional, here's how you breathe, here's let's have a conversation, bringing you back to, lack of a better word, the world of the living. At the same time, there's an instrumental help, you know, how to explain this to your children, where to go at home, how to hide or save yourself. Who's helping the people on the helpline?
What a timely question. This morning I received an update from Natal. Our clinical unit just opened a helpline for our volunteers and social workers and therapists because we understand that they also need the support. I'll share another interesting initiative that I've done here with the American Friends of Natal. You know, October 8th, I got hundreds of emails from Israeli therapists in the U.S., U.S. therapists that are Jewish and want to help out in Israel. And I said, okay, let me start an Excel sheet because that's what you do when you have a lot of information and you don't know what to do with it yet. And at some point in one of our events, someone said to me, why don't you create a mental health affinity group? Because these are people who get the work that Natal is doing, but they are overseas. Now, there is something to say about a mental health professional volunteering from the U.S. to help someone in Israel. It's not always welcome. You know, Israelis have their own typecast, all of that. We won't get into it, but I think
in general, it's hard to help someone or completely empathize with someone who is going through a different daily routine than you. It's the same reason why women sometimes seek female therapists. while Jews seek Jewish therapists, why African-Americans seek African-American therapists. Not always, not all the time. But there is that idea that we're going through something that others can't understand.
Correct. And that's why I formed this group that meets once a month with a Natal therapist. And from what I've heard, yes, the content that Natal has to give, the exporting the expertise is so critical and meaningful to people here, but also the connection with the Natal therapist that she knows she's got 25 people here that support her on Zoom from the same industry she's in once a month, and they get it. They get what she's going through. They know they can't help people in Israel because they don't understand, they don't share the same reality as them, but this is a place where they can actually, where peer connection makes a big difference.
So you have the helpline, but then you also go beyond, obviously, just the phones. You have clinical treatment, clinical support. What does Natal do with that?
So somebody can call the helpline, and two things can happen. One, our helpline is unique. It offers outgoing calls. So if you call me, I'm a volunteer, and we have a conversation, we get you to a place where you're okay, you're back to, you're regulated, you're able to go on with your day. And I say to you, would you like to have a conversation with me again next week, the same time? And so you could either have a helpline relationship where it mimics therapy because there's an outgoing call on a weekly basis, a conversation with a volunteer.
Wow. So wait, let's stop on that for a second, because a lot of people, I mean, this is news to me, and a lot of people would be shocked. It sounds very groundbreaking. Typically, hotlines tend to be very passive. Why shift the paradigm here?
Because having a conversation at many times is enough. Something consistent in a client's life could be enough, and they don't necessarily need the clinical support. So it's important to assess the needs of the people that are calling, and that way you're making sure that you're not over-offering, right? We know there is a mental health crisis in Israel right now. And so I think for many people, just having that conversation is enough, and it's a great solution, so why not offer it?
Incredible. And so, but then you mentioned that because there are people that it goes beyond the phone call.
Correct. Some people need the extra support. They'll be referred into our clinical unit. Our clinical unit can offer anything from one-on-one therapy, family therapy, group therapy. We have support groups. Another thing that's very unique about Natal is that it recognizes that it's not only the individual that is coping with the trauma, but it's also their circles of support. So it could be children, spouse, parents, grandparents, neighbors, cousins, and there's this overlooking of the entire community that's surrounding the person coping with trauma, and an understanding that everybody needs to heal to make this humanity thing move forward, right? And so with the clinical unit, clearly the numbers have more than quadrupled after October 7th, but there has always been a need there.
Now, and so these are both reactive, but then you also have the proactive community resilience programs. What are those programs, and how do they fit into the whole Natal infrastructure?
So the community resilience unit is, it goes out to the communities. We know the power of community, and we know that by strengthening a community, whether it's an organization, a neighborhood, a city, we know that by strengthening the community, it will be able to help itself out after a crisis. And so I'll give you an example. The past 24 hours, Natal has been going into organizations, businesses in Israel, and having a processing moment, a conversation, giving a little more tools for HR professionals who are now not only coping with, you know, manpower issues between employees or benefits or things like that, but the possibility of somebody remaining homeless, because their house was hit by a missile or is missing a neighbor, a friend, a family member until everything uncovers or continues to uncover. And it's
kids are at home.
Exactly. No, being reactive is feet on the ground, going out there and engaging with the community, giving them tools to cope. Another fascinating project that Natal has done post October 7th, the Community Resilience Unit partnered up with the Israel Community Center, Chevra LeMatnasim, which is spread out all over Israel. It's like JCCs, right? And they identified leaders from within the community, and Natal, in partnership with the IACC, took them on retreats outside of Israel. So it was one, take care of these people, give them a little relief, but also create a task force. So this group, I met with this group of women, they came back and they had a task force. They were from the Gaza envelope. And it keeps them together and it keeps them moving and it keeps the momentum and the engagement. So building resiliency isn't a one-time thing. It's an exercise. It's going to the gym, but for your mental health.
And can any community organization bring Natal in for resilience building? Is there some process that we need to go through?
So in Israel, you call Natal, the Community Resiliency Unit, and they will give instructions. But in the U.S., we do a similar thing where we export Natal's knowledge and bring it into U.S. communities that have asked for it. We do that under our global department, and it's more of a business relationship where Natal trains, teaches, monitors, supervises, and then the work continues for that community that's contracted Natal, but on their own.
Can you speak a bit about the communities in the U.S., whatever you're allowed
sure.
to speak about?
So we have an incredible call center in Bronzeville, Chicago. It's called TURN, and it was modeled after Natal's helpline. They celebrated their 10-year anniversary not long ago, and their pastor, Pastor Chris Harris, went to Israel on a mission with AIPAC, I think, more than 10 years ago and said, this helpline, this I want for my community. And his community copes with violence, gun violence, very different things. But the model of the helpline and creating a space for the community to come together and realize that they need the support was something that spoke to him. And I had the honor of visiting there twice already. They took the Natal model, but they adapted it to their community's needs. And I think it's a beautiful partnership. I love personally seeing things like that come into fruition.
I'm sorry if this might be a bit of a ridiculous question, but Natal deals with drama related to terrorism, rocket launches, knivings on a national, you know, basis in Israel. What does it have to do with shootings in Bronzeville, Chicago?
Trauma is trauma. So it could be, I mean, the mind experiences trauma the same way, you know, in result to gun violence or a suicide bombing. The treatment would be the same. It's still trauma. And the adaptation piece is cultural. So it's about, you know, and again, I'm not a mental health professional, but a trauma-informed therapist is trauma-informed, and they can adapt that skill set to any trauma experience. So the helpline worked because the idea of people having a place to call with trained volunteers spoke to the pastor. He knew that is a solution his community needed for a different problem, but it was still under the trauma umbrella, if that makes sense.
And what's Natal's interest in doing this? Why not just focus in Israel? Why do these collaborations? You have an entire global you know, parts?
So I would say Natal during emergency is very focused on providing service for Israelis. There is no desire to expand, knowing full well that the work to be done is in Israel. We've all seen the numbers and know how many Israelis there are and what's the expected people to be coping with PTSD. But there is a lot to global partnerships and experience of 28 years. And being able to export it is also, I think, a moment of pride of saying, we've experienced all of this. If you want to learn from us, we can offer that. So I think it's a balance, honestly, about first and foremost, continuing to provide the much needed response to Israelis. But it's also knowing that the world is looking at Israel and realizing that it's a lab right now of learning about mass trauma, a mass mental health crisis. So it's both. It's a little bit of both. It's like diplomacy within an organization, right? Everybody wants to be able to show to the world what they're doing and what an expert they are on what they are doing.
Which brings me to the fourth project that I really am interested in, because that is something that, honestly, I have no idea what it means. Trauma-informed career services. Now, I know what each of those four words mean, but I don't know how they go together.
So the career development model was written about 3 years ago, and the unit launched before October 7th. The idea was seeing all the audience that was going through Natal, whether the helpline, the clinical unit, or the community resiliency department, the need for young people that were going in and out of Gaza or post their military service. They didn't know what they wanted to do when they grow up. It was more about within their one-stop shop, being able to offer them guidance, but without forgetting that they are coping with PTSD. So I think I'll give you a different example so that maybe this clarifies it. But not too long ago, our helpline volunteers were given a training on trauma-informed suicide, which is different than suicide, because PTSD impacts the brain in more ways than we can imagine or we understand. And that's where the career development needs to give that same support. So it's different from a person who is not coping with trauma or PTSD that's going for career development, career mentoring. With the career trauma-informed career development, it's finding a mentor that knows how to address symptoms in the workplace. It's giving the client the tools to come into work and know what triggers them and know what kind of routine they need to schedule so that their PTSD doesn't interfere with their work life, but also tools to cope with their PTSD if it does.
That's very interesting. To me, that sounds very almost like the essence of Zionism, which is, we're not necessarily going to help people, but we're going to help people help themselves. You know, the prototypical PTSD figure in movies, in TV dramas, is someone who is suffering so much that they are forced to drop out of society. And it seems like what you're doing is helping them not only stay in society, but figure out how to do it in the best way possible.
And integrate and stay relevant while doing it. And I will say that the career development unit has seen a tremendous growth over the past nearly 2 years as a result of October 7th. But it's also, to me, you're right, it's a way to make sure that the integration back into society is done carefully and thoughtfully.
So this is probably on everyone's mind, but how has your work changed since October 7?
Besides the growth, tremendous growth, more than quadrupled, both manpower and the people we service, I will say that besides the growth, there's an understanding of what is the invisible wound and what is collective trauma, national trauma. And I think, as I said before, pre-October 7th, I would meet with donors, people who have known me, you know Jewish geography. It's a small world. So in the nonprofit sector, it's also a very Jewish nonprofit sector. It's a small world. And I had many conversations and people just don't, you know, if you don't want to know, if it doesn't affect you, do you want to know about somebody's PTSD? I'm not so sure. And after October 7th, I felt like people wanted to listen because they understood, because they felt it, because they couldn't ignore it. And that's, I would say, what really changed the work and the way we communicate here. It's all about the narrative regardless. So at the October 7th narrative was very clear to everyone. Trauma was real and it was felt across the globe if you were Jewish or not in some cases.
Does the work sometime get to you?
Of course. I think, and I feel bad saying it because I'm here in the U.S., right? I'm not at Natal, Saturday morning I woke up. I had over 1,000 messages in my WhatsApp from work, and I saw the numbers and they got to me. And I said, my parents are in Haifa. I have family in places that have been hit. And it was just shocking. How do you get on with your day? So, of course, the work gets to us. I think we wouldn't be human otherwise.
Which brings us to the latest tragedy or development. How is Natal responding to the most recent attacks from Iran? And basically, millions of civilian population, Jews, Christians, Muslims, under constant barrage of rockets, not knowing, there's no rhyme or reason to them. If you're a civilian, you're targeted. How are you reacting to that?
So Natal, look, the helpline numbers speak for themselves. In 4 days, we've had 1,100 calls, which is, I think, more than 5 times the typical calls. And our clinical unit has taken in 300 patients in 3 days, which is also unheard of. As I said before, I think what Natal is doing now, I don't think I know, is taking care of their own people. It's realizing that we have to support the supporters. And as I said, we have that helpline. We have some supervision from our head psychologists that do a little Zoom sessions for all the therapists and volunteers and staff. It's important to check in with everyone. And I would say that's something that I'm very proud to see that they're doing at Natal. And being active with sending out the resiliency unit into organizations and businesses and making sure that everyone who is communicating to staff has the right tools and language to be able to do so.
And while all of this is happening, and I know, people watching or listening might feel like overwhelmed right now, because sometimes reality is overwhelming. Just by in our conversations, we've covered pre-October 7 trauma, which is still ongoing. Terrorist attacks are happening still on almost a weekly basis. Post-October 7th trauma, which is still ongoing. Iran attacks trauma. But then you have a fourth trauma, which is still ongoing, of the hostages that are still held in Gaza, the hostage families, and the released hostages that are dealing with very unique traumas. How is Natal dealing with that, let's say, fourth level of trauma?
So Natal has opened a helpline in a partnership with the Kamim Foundation, which is the Hostage Family Forum, and created their own avenue into Natal. So they have their own helpline and their own coordinator for any treatments, any therapies they want. It's meeting them where they need to be met. So when they are ready, when these families are ready, and it is the families, it's the community, it's the extended families, I would say. It's not only mom and dad, sister and brother, it's grandparents, cousins. I think every single layer of trauma has a point of contact at Natal. And it's evolving, unfortunately, evolving and continuing to adapt as we go along.
So one thing that's interesting is that you're not the CEO of Natal, you're the CEO of American Friends of Natal, which begs the question of why does Natal need American friends? And why should Americans care?
Natal is funded 30% by government, 30% by partnerships, and 30% by philanthropy, hence the need for the American Friends of Natal. We are a fundraising arm to make sure that any Israeli that goes through treatment does not pay a fee. So all the philanthropy...
No fee at all.
No fee at all. When you call Natal, you are not charged. When you receive treatments, you are not charged. There is no fee at all. And so that's what philanthropy is for. And my personal philosophy is that this is an actual way for Americans, American Jews, Israeli Americans to help to support the state of Israel in an apolitical way. The need is there. The need is absolutely there. And our role also as American Friends of Natal is to raise awareness that what everyone is feeling here, you know, we're also a circle of trauma. Israeli Americans in the U.S., American Jews, it's also impacted us. I'm sure you've heard the October 8th Jew term so many times. And so this is an actual way to get involved. It's not always donating money. Sometimes it's donating time, your skill set, sharing an idea, helping develop something. It doesn't always have to be money. I know philanthropy sounds like give us the money, but there's a lot more that goes into that.
So what can Americans who want to get involved more with their money, with their skill set, what can they do? Who can they reach out to?
Me, of course.
you've got to be careful. We got tens of thousands of watchers, and like you're going to have a lot of people reaching out directly to you, Mayan.
Let that be the worst of my problem. I'm a people person. I like to hear what people think. I think any ideas is something worth listening to. I believe strongly that communities and people help move things. So it's important for me to hear what people think because I see so many great causes popping up and doing great things, but I believe in collective combined power and that we can work together because this is a problem that impacts everyone.
So before we end, I want to ask you a question that may be a bit on the personal side, but at the end of the day, after maybe that your day doesn't end, but assuming it ends at some point, after receiving, you know, dozens, hundreds of messages and emails, seeing all this trauma that is out there and all the good you're trying to achieve, sometimes successfully, sometimes it's hard. How do you, Mayan Aviv, cope with it all?
I certainly lean on my friends and family. And I stay very active. I believe in yoga and the power of physical activity to release a lot of the stress that we hold inside. But I also believe in the power of connection. And I know that when I speak to a friend who might be having a better day than me today, she'll give me her powers, her superpowers. And then tomorrow when the day is tough for her, I know she'll turn to me. So it's having meaningful connections and really counting on them to make your days go by and be meaningful.
Well, we end this episode like any other episode with what we call the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay, I'll try.
Most important thing is honesty. Mayan Aviv, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I love to cook.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Poof. We're all people.
What is your favorite curse?
Can I say it on live?
You can say whatever you want.
Fuckery.
Fuckery. That's like it's half a curse, half
a... It's a description of a situation.
Is that an adverb, an adjective? What is it?
I think it's a description.
It's a description. So, okay. When was the last time you cried?
Last serious time was probably the Friday after October 7th. And I think it was the first time I put my head up from the table after literally being Zoom after Zoom after Zoom for that whole week. And my neighbor invited me for Shabbat dinner, my American neighbor. And as soon as she lit the candles, it just devastated me. And that was my release, I would say.
Which ties us to the next question. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I think Golda Meir. I'd love to hear her point of view on everything that's happening right now.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Rosh Hashanah.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
When do you feel safest?
At home with my family.
When do you feel least safe?
These days, walking around Manhattan, honestly.
What is it that makes you feel unsafe walking around Manhattan?
I think the freedom of on the streets is could be a... I had an experience in the city a few weeks ago where it was pouring rain, and my coworker had the hostage pin on her blazer, and these two young men came under my umbrella. We were walking together, and as soon as they saw that I was with her, they started saying Free Palestine and baby killer and all that.
They were using your umbrella to stay away from
the rain?
They were
under my umbrella. I at first thought...
Literally under your umbrella.
Literally under my umbrella. I thought they were hitting on me. I know I'm a little older for them, but I said, who knows? It's raining. Maybe they can't see well. But it got real. And I didn't feel threatened for my life. But it's that how quickly things change and out of your control that scared me. And to the point where I walk in the streets of Manhattan and I don't speak Hebrew because I am scared. So I think that's the scary place to be right now.
Wow. Well, I walk in the streets of Manhattan and speak Hebrew dafka in spite to show people like stay away. But to me, it's your story. I've never heard this kind of story. It's almost like the scorpion and the frog, and the scorpion, they bite because that's what they do. Like you're literally helping someone, giving them cover from the rain, but they cannot help themselves from the hatred.
Yeah, it was scary. As soon as they realized that I'm with her, that was it.
So This makes the next question even more important. What gives you hope?
People. Human connection. That gives me hope. It's speaking to people and believing that we can make the world a better place is the only thing that keeps me going. I think that's hope.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week? And I'm going to give you two. I'm going to say Natal, of course. Where can people donate to Natal?
You can donate to American Friends of Natal. We have a website, afnatal.org. I would honestly say that mental health is an evolving crisis in Israel. I mean, it's happening, but it's also continuing. So I would encourage people to donate to mental health causes in Israel. If not Natal, there are so many worthy causes that do very similar work with niche audiences. And I completely encourage people to donate if they can.
Well, Maayan, I'm going to end the episode. And I think something that I've never said before on this show, but honestly, I wish you didn't exist. I wish there was no need for you. There was no need for trauma services. There were no trauma. Unfortunately, we live in a world where you don't get all your wishes.
I don't take it personally, and I 1,000% agree with you.
So thank you so much for taking time of your day. For coming here, I look forward to all the work you're going to be doing. And here I am with Maayan Aviv.
Thank you.
This is some bonus special for people that are live, people in our fan groups. So let me just ask that question again for people who didn't hear it on the mic. Does your organization integrate into its work religious-based, spiritual-based activities, either prayer or things like yoga, meditation? And what are the outcomes that you've seen?
It's a great question. So we do both. We have trauma-informed yoga, part of our community resiliency unit. I actually got to meet a group from the Gaza envelope that was part of, it was 8 women and 1 man. And you could see the relationship they have with the yoga instructor. It's a trauma-informed yoga instructor. You just see how meaningful it is getting something on the routine for them as a group, and it's movement, and it still releases some of the trauma, but in a different way. So certainly very, very impactful and helpful. And as for spiritual guidance, we do a lot of workshops with the Rabbinical Assembly, with spiritual leaders across the world, because we know that post-trauma, many people turn to belief as a way to cope and deal. It's a mechanism. And so we're able to support those who offer that spiritual guidance to make them a little more trauma-informed.
Can we heal from trauma, or do we just have to deal with trauma?
I think it's both. We heal and we deal. I think trauma changes us. Think about any experience you've had as an individual and how it has shifted how you think or what you do. So I think we can heal from trauma, but it's always going to remain a part of us. So the question now is, how do we grow from it? It's not how do we heal or deal. It's how do we take what's happened to us and take control of it and grow from it, learn and grow from it.
But what about a trauma as big as October 7, which is affecting so many people at once?
Look at all the good things that have happened since October 7th. I know it sounds very counterintuitive, but I think with healing, with growing, our role is also to show hope, to provide hope. And so many things, great things have happened. So many people have come together. So many people have changed their beliefs or adapted or whether they got closer to Judaism or they started doing volunteer work or they decided to check in with a friend on a daily basis. Every little thing makes a difference. And I think as Jews across the world, we're learning, coping, dealing, healing, and changing as a result of October 7th. So I don't think many have stayed static post-October 7th. I think at least the people I've been in touch with have been impacted in a way that's either shifted what they've done in their professional life or shifted what they do in their homes in terms of Jewish values or how they engage with their community. So I think and it's funny, history books will tell, right? When we look back in 20, 30, 40 years, what we've done as a community. And I think history books will say we've done a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."